Accession number 19671, Real One.
Harry McLean, Real One. Where were you born, please?
Portsmouth, Hampshire.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Portsmouth?
Yes, I did.
Which school did you go to there?
Stampshaw Boys was the first school I went to, which is still in existence. And then, part of the modernisation process, I suppose, a new school was built in Portsmouth, Northern Parade, and I went there.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
15.
So that must have been in 38.
No. I actually was fortunate that I carried on at school. I shouldn't have done so because we moved from the Portsmouth area outside their educational thing. I was able to do this because my father was a full-time regular petty officer in the Navy at sea quite often, and my mother didn't seem to have much interest or knowledge, so I was able to carry on at Portsmouth. And I actually stayed there until August 1939, when it was obvious that we weren't coming back to school again. For one thing, the school, we were told, had been earmarked as a naval hospital, and that was when I left school.
Just before the war started?
Yes, yes.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did.
Under what circumstances?
Well, at 11 o'clock on the Sunday morning, I immediately went out into the street where I met a friend of mine, and we discussed this and looked up in the air, and I think we were quite disappointed that nothing happened. So they'd be over tonight, but it was some while before they did come over.
Did you get a job?
Yes. The circumstances were rather curious. My father was actually on leave at that time, and he had a couple of cronies, one of whom had won some money on the Irish sweep, and they were flying around enjoying the last elements, I suppose, on the south coast. My mother evacuated herself to Exeter to stay with her sister, with my brother and two sisters. I was left to my own devices. My father came in one day and said, well, I think it's about time you got a job. So I actually got a job working for W.A. Smith & Sons, delivering papers from Fareham Railway Station.
How did the war first affect you then?
Well, really, you can go back to the crisis in 1938, when Chamberlain went to Munich. Everybody was aware that the situation was, you know, dodgy, shall we say. But the I found out that the local tramway depot in North End of Portsmouth, the canteen was being used for the putting together of gas masks. They came in about five different pieces, and they were assembled, that's the word I'm trying to think of, in the canteen. And a friend of mine and myself, after school, we used to go there and put gas masks together, for which we got a free cup of tea. And so you can say that's when the war started for me.
Is it difficult to put them together?
Well, no, it's quite clever. You start off with the basic cylinder, and you wrap the rubber face piece around that to a sort of ridge halfway down. You have a thick rubber band, which was put into a sort of machine, which when you press the handle, fingers, shall we say, expanded the rubber band. You drop the gas mask in to that and push the handle further down, when the rubber band flew off and gripped the rubber face piece rather around the cylinder. And inside there was a very floppy valve put in, just a rubber valve. And that was it.
And this was in Portsmouth, you were?
Yes, yes.
When was it that you were doing it?
1938.
And was there a quota of gas masks that you had to get through?
Well, no. People just turned up and put them together. We went after school. We thought it was rather smart, I suppose, to get a free cup of tea. I don't know why, but something for nothing, you know.
And I was asking you how the war first affected you.
Oh, well, after that, I discovered that the IRP services were starting, so I became an IRP messenger. That was quite interesting. Of course, I didn't stay delivering papers for long, by the way. I got another job down in Portsmouth Dockyard, working on the Queen Elizabeth, which was a battleship which was being updated, refitted, they call it. It was about at the end of its refit. I worked on it for a year. I loved it.
What job were you doing?
Boilermaker's apprentice.
What did that involve?
Well, plating, really. Worked with a man and you were learning the trade, so to speak. It wasn't a real apprenticeship, but that's what they were called, an apprentice. And of course, the shipyards in those days were very large percentage of boys working there. I quite liked it. Eventually, I landed up with a welder and another lad as a labourer working on my own. This is what I liked about it, because if you showed any aptitude, they made use of it. The foreman, I was working for Fairfields, by the way, the firm from Govan in Scotland, and they were re-engineering the Queen Elizabeth. The foreman was a chap called Davy Rose. He was an old-time foreman, a big fellow with a big, what we would nowadays call a beer gut and a bowler hat. Gruff, if you like, but as kind-hearted as you can get, you know. And he got me putting up the engine room gratings and steps. These things were prefabricated in the yard in Scotland and sent down in crates. But when you put the engines and that together in these battleships, there's various pipes that have got to be made to fit various places. And of course, the gratings don't always fit. So we have to cut pieces out to get round pipes. But the main thing was erecting them so that they were fit to walk on, which meant that you had put stanchions up and weld to what in naval terms a deckhead, but what we would call the ceiling. And I had this 20-year-old welder as my welder, and a lad of about 14 as a labourer. We put these gratings and steps in and enjoyed it.
Was it hard work?
No, it's very enjoyable. Men used to sing at work in those days. One of the first chaps I worked with, a chap called Charlie Swift, he was a very interesting man. He told me all about the Roman roads in the Hampshire that went to Winchester and places like that, and that kind of thing. And no, it's very good. I enjoyed every minute of it. But I came to work one day and the ship was gone. It obviously become, shall we say, an attractive target for the Germans if they wanted to. I mean, it was almost complete. So they put a couple of pom-pom guns on the hangars, and that they were manned. And, of course, during the air raids, we were told to leave these men alone. But, of course, what happened, half the chaps that worked on the ship was on top of the hangars passing the ammunition. The ammunition on a pom-pom gun seemed to be in clips, like the rifles, only of course it was, the shell was about 2 inches, you know, thick. And it got plenty of encouragement. And then, of course, after the ship had gone, there was an opportunity of working on a cruiser called the Sirius. But I chose to go and work nearer home, and I went to Vospers, the people who make the fast launches, and worked on motor torpedo boats.
Doing what?
Well, plating again. So I claim, with my tongue in my cheek, that I've worked on the largest and smallest ships in the Navy.
How do you do a plating job?
Well, it's only metal work, really, like blacksmithing sort of thing. What happened with these motor torpedo boats? They were designed for Italian engines, Isotta Francini engines, and the quota that they'd ordered, I think 101, they ran out of, and of course the war had started, there was no chance of getting any of those engines, so they had to find another source. So the result was that these motor torpedo boats, which took about 3 weeks to build the hull, were being churned out with no engines, and they were put out on the mudflats around. So they then discovered, I suppose, that the Merlin engine would adapt, and so Merlin engines that were made by Packards in Canada started to come through. There are three engines in each boat, by the way, and the bearings for these engines differed from the Italian ones, obviously, and they were prefabricated in the Southern Railway engine works in Eastleigh. So these things came through, which myself, the same situation again, I had two lads working with me, I was 17 by then, by the way, they were bolted together lightly. A shipwright would come and true them up so that they were in the correct alignment with the propeller shaft, and then we would rivet them together, and so what they call piecework. But I quite enjoyed it, you know, you're left on your own to get on with it.
Was the money good?
Well, relatively. I'm not sure what I got paid at Vospers, but I do remember quite clearly that I got 39 shillings a week in the dockyard of Fairfield, so it would be about the same. And a man's wages then was about £2.05.
Were you satisfied with that money?
Oh, certainly, yes. That's to give my mother a pound. She took a pound and I had 19 shillings. And I had a girlfriend, used to take her to the pictures on a Sunday. Oh, quiet stuff, you know. And after, well, 3 or 4 months, I finally had a few quid in my wallet. So I put that in the post office. And when I joined the Air Force, I had £70, which was quite a bit of money in those days.
What was life like in Portsmouth at that time?
Well, I should have mentioned, I suppose, that in 1936, I believe it was, we moved from Portsmouth to Porchester. So all that I'm telling you now, I lived in Porchester then right from the start, in 1938. It's just outside the Portsmouth boundary. It was very good. At first I didn't like it much, but there was a lot of freedom there. Still very much of a village in those days. There's a Roman castle there, one of the oldest buildings in Britain, I think. One of the best preserved. And of course, you know what lads are. We climbed all over that, bit every piece and a lot of freedom, but then the Home Guard started, and I got a bit fed up with the ARP messengering. What used to happen when the Germans started their raids on Portsmouth, almost every night, I'd leave work at 5, I'd get home, it's about 7 miles, but I'd get home somewhere around about 5:30, I expect, a very good cyclist, and usually, it was quite coincidental, really. The siren for the air raid warning would go as I was entering the village. Quite often, I'd just wave to my mother and go by straight to the warden's post, which in Portchester was in a builder's yard. And then you wait there, and the air raid state was graded from white, yellow, purple and red, I think. Anyway, it was white, and you did nothing. But then when you got the message that the grading was yellow, as the messenger, I used to go around and knock up the other wardens. Well, of course, quite often this would be in the middle of the night. And I must have woken up the street, leaping off a bike and banging on the doors, you know. But I got a bit fed up with that, really, because I only had the ordinary gas mask. You had nothing except an armband. And the Home Guard had started. So when I was 17, that was the minimum age, I believe, because you had to have a firearm certificate, which you couldn't get until you were 17. I joined the Home Guard. And
is this the Porchester?
Yes, 14th Farron Battalion, Hampshire Regiment.
And what did you do in the LDV?
Well, now you hear a lot and read a lot, like Dad's Army, of people being armed with broomsticks and pickaxes and that kind of thing, which no doubt was true in some parts of the country. But of course, we were in the front line. And so we weren't long without rifles. We had brand new, had a Remington. These were 300 bore American rifles from the First World War, absolutely brand new, caked in grease. They were different than the British Army by the bore. You couldn't fire a British bullet through these. But we had these. We had the full uniform, overcoats, caps, boots, everything. And I was a signaller. That was semaphore, of course, in those days.
And what kind of training did you get with them?
Well, nothing really. As I look back, the backbone of our platoon was pensioners from the Royal Marines. And they were great chaps. And we paraded on Sunday. We had the odd occasional church parade, but we used to do training. Now, there was a chief petty officer in the Navy, a gunnery chap in the village. He used to come and take us in hand and instruct us. We had a gun called a Northover projector. This was really like a piece of drain pipe on a tripod, but it was a weapon. It used to fire what's known as a Molotov cocktail. That's a glass bottle filled with petrol. We've seen quite a bit of this in Belfast, you know, and fire them. And I suppose it would fire one of these about 70 feet, something like that. The object was you fire it at a tank, fire this glass container into the tracks of a tank where it would crack and catch fire. I think there was phosphorus involved somewhere. And the idea was it would burn off the rubber that was coating some of the, I think they're called jockey wheels, for the tank track. So the track would then become so loose it would fall off and the tank would be useless. It worked. But of course the villagers laughed at, look at the Home Guard with their toy gun. But it was far from being a toy. Because you had bayonets and everything. Two of our chaps, one of them was the second in command. He was a butcher, a lieutenant. A man called Bruno. They were at ranges in Gosport, practicing throwing hand grenades. And one rolled back in the trench and blew up and killed the two of them.
What did you say his name was?
Bruno now. He's got a military headstone in Porchester Churchyard. Then there was a consequence of this, to this, really, because the leading light was a local coal man, a man called Boxall, Bill Boxall. He was one of these people you meet, a lot of leadership about him, you see. So, of course, we had a military funeral for these two chaps, and because all the Marines turned out with their rows of medals, and Bill Boxall had none. He was what they call the colour sergeant. Now, that finished him with that platoon in a way, because everyone was shocked. They thought he had medals, and so he left. But he went down to Portsmouth, where the Home Guard there actually had an anti-aircraft gun. There's a few around the country, and he went on this gun, and I understand that they were the first Home Guard guns to be accredited with bringing down a German plane. So he had something about him.
Whereabouts did you meet?
In the village hall, which is still there.
In Porchester?
Yes.
But it was called the Fareham LDV.
Ah, Fareham Battalion. Porchester Platoon, Fareham Battalion, 14th Fareham Battalion, Hampshire Regiment Home Guard. Now, the object of this was, our duties with Portsmouth Harbour is a tidal harbour. And the theory was that the Germans could land on the harbour in flying boats as a possibility. So there were a couple of barges in the creek with barrage balloons on, and the Home Guard, we used to go out an hour and a half before high tide to one or two pillboxes that were dotted around the foreshore, and I know a couple that are still there, and do 3 hours there, hour and a half after high tide, we go back in. Now, there was myself and two friends about the same age. We were one of these three-man teams. There were others, of course. And one of the jobs we used to do was to go up the keep of Porchester Castle. It was pretty eerie going up the steps of that. The grounds of Porchester Castle, there was a barrage balloon there run by WAFs. And one of the Roman turrets on the castle had been floored over with a Lewis gun on it. And we used to go and stand on that and look out over the harbour. And I often reflected that I was standing in the same place as a Roman soldier must have stood many a time, centuries ago.
Any incidents that happened to you with this LDV unit?
No, not really, I don't think. Of course, you know what lads are, you know, we used to lark about quite a bit, but it was quite serious. We had these rifles with ammunition. Of course, the big fear of the country then was parachutists, you see, dropping down. And I did hear an argument in the shire, in the village hall once between two of them. Is absolutely stupid. Well, I could see that myself, that if one of them was in the hall and a German parachutist come in, he'd just as soon have a hammer as a rifle, because the parachutist didn't know where he's going to throw the hammer at him. It's absolutely ludicrous. And, you know, the German parachutist has got a name as being one of the toughest soldiers in the world. I think he'd bother to look, and just bang, and that's it. But of course, it was a different way of life in those days.
Did you think the Germans would invade yourself?
Well, frankly, I wasn't skilled enough to know. In fact, one of the things I say about the war, I wish I'd been a couple of years older to have understood it more. You see, Mr. Churchill was always telling us that the Germans couldn't win. I have his speeches on tape here now. And of course he was telling us the truth. When you look back, he wrote books about the war after the war, and got various titles. The Hinge of Fate is one anyway. And he's telling us all the way through that. The people that thought about these things knew that we were going to have a war. They miscalculated the start date. They thought it was going to be more like 1943 or 40, 41, something like that. They knew roughly how long it was going to last, and in a fairly clear way, the course it was going to take. And so when Mr. Churchill was saying that Hitler couldn't win, he was telling us the truth. Great inspirational speeches he made at the time.
Did you listen to them at the time?
Oh, yes, yes. The 9 o'clock news, everybody listened to. That was sacrosanct. And he didn't pull his punches, told us when things were grim, but bear up.
What happened to you next?
Well, I'd always wanted to fly, so I volunteered when I was 17 and a quarter for the RAF. I passed the medical and was sent to Uxbridge for the tests of that, which I passed, and I was sworn in and took the oath and posted to Blackpool. But of course, it didn't suit me really, because I hadn't thought I was leaving home for good when I left home to go for the interview. Neither did a few more. So Mum Bryce back said, well, let's put in for a 48-hour pass and to report to Blackpool in 48 hours. So they put this to the corporal in this squad, and he went off and came back approved. But of course, he then said, well, which one of you is McLean? I said, I am. He said, well, I'm afraid you're going to have to go home again. I said, well, what's up? He said, well, he said, we don't take you until you're 18. So I went home on what was termed deferred service. And it was arranged a local schoolmaster who gave me educational instruction, I think two evenings a week. I went to see him and had some schooling. But, of course, when I became 18, I got a bit edgy about this, and I wrote various letters to whom, God knows, the Air Minister, I suppose. And eventually I got called to the colours, as they say. I doubt that my letters had anything to do with it. It was probably the course of time. So on the 17th of March, 1942, I joined the RAF full time, and it was almost a year exactly before that, in 1941, that I was accepted.
What did you want to do in the RAF?
Oh, I wanted to be a pilot, the same as the rest, you know. And I was down as general duties, under training pilot. I can diverge a little bit here. When I was at Vosperus, one of our woodworking chaps left and joined the army. So after about a month, he came back wearing a kilt and went and spoke to all his friends again. A fortnight later, he was back on his bench making boats. They got him out of the army, and I often wondered if anybody had ever inquired about getting me out of the RAF, but it seems that the air crew was the only trade you could get in if you had what they call a reserve trade, you see. They release you for that. But if I'd wanted to join as anything else, I wouldn't have been allowed to leave.
So what was the pattern of your training?
Well, I reported to, told to report to Lord's Cricket Ground. So in some odd sort of way, I thought, oh, well, they must have turned the cricket ground into an aerodrome. And I figured there'd be aeroplanes and have a tinker about with this, that kind of thing. Quite a shock. It was still Lord's Cricket Ground, but you got kitted out with a uniform there. I lived in a block of flats called Hall Road, St John's Wood. This is a common place to go. Well, whilst I was there, one of the recruits, now I can normally remember his name, but I began with C. He murdered a prostitute in London. He lived in Bentinck Court. And of course, before they actually got him, apparently he left his cap at the scene. And we used to wear a white flash to denote that we were potential officers, with all kinds of restrictions placed.